The Tom Woods Show, episode 1519.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I have the best, nicest, smartest, brightest group of like-minded, friendly folks you can possibly imagine, where we learn from each other, we get outraged with each other, we rejoice with each other. It's a wonderful community of folks, and you, as a loyal listener of The Tom Woods Show, belong inside it. It's called The Tom Woods Show Elite, and you can get in there via supportinglisteners.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Let me set the stage for what we're doing on this episode today by letting you know that I'm heading out of town this week for the Mises Institute Supporters Summit out in Los Angeles. I'll be traveling on Thursday of this week, and then the event runs Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I am sort of scrambling to get ready, and I've got a little something for you from the vault, from the archives that you've never heard before, chances are. Or if you have, there's no way you remember anything from it. So I'll get to that in a minute, exactly what I'm doing here. But the rest of the week, just this one episode I'm drawing from the vault. The rest of the week, all fresh episodes, even during the days I'm out of town, because that is the kind of podcast host I am. I know you guys would be very understanding if I said I'm going to be out of town for a couple of days, there won't be episodes, but I can't bring myself to do that. Now, I want to say something before going any further. In yesterday's episode, I talked about Tulsi Gabbard, and I said that it was a shame that given that she stuck her neck out for Bernie Sanders, that Bernie had not, in return, stuck his neck out to say, by the way, it's a pretty crummy thing for Hillary Clinton to make this fact-free accusation that Tulsi is some kind of a Russian asset. Well, he did finally defend her the day I released that episode. Later in the day, several hours after I recorded it, he came out and said something finally, but he was very slow to do it. Several other people in the race had done so before him. He was slow to do it, but he did do it. So I want to acknowledge that, if that makes you feel any better. But I just want to make sure that the record is clear here on this. I don't want to leave that hanging, given that there was additional information that came out. All right. So let me say also another event that's coming up, November 9th, 2019, is the Symposium with Ron Paul in Lake Jackson, Texas. And if you are interested in going to that, it's $55 for non-members of the Mises Institute, $40 for members of the Mises Institute, and $30 for members of my supporting listeners program. So there are unannounced bonuses that you get in addition to all the other bonuses. From time to time, you get discounts like this. So that's a pretty nice deal. It's a great event with a full breakfast buffet, some great speakers. I'll be there. It's going to be a lot of fun. And Scott Horton, it's going to be just great. So if you want that deal, and you're a supporting listener of the show, then just drop me a line at the contact page at tomwoods.com, and I'll get you set up with that special deal. If you're not a supporting listener and you'd like to go, sign up to become one, supportinglisteners.com, and then just drop me a line, and I'll make sure you get that special deal. All right, today what I've got for you is an interview Peter Schiff did of me back on the old Peter Schiff Show all the way in November of 2010. So this is basically 9 years ago that we did this interview, but it holds up pretty well. I mean, we talk about economics, history, politics, all that stuff that Peter and I like to talk about, and I hope you enjoy it. Here we go.
And now without further ado, let me go to my guest, Thomas Woods, who's probably, you know, my favorite economist out there. He's a great speaker. He's got a great sense of humor. He understands Austrian economics. But anyway, Tom, are you there?
I sure am, Peter. Congratulations on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So can you believe what these guys are doing, what the Fed is doing, what Congress is doing, that they learned absolutely nothing from mistakes they made just a year or two ago?
Yeah, and I guess what is most frustrating about this is that there are so many Americans out there who went into November 2nd thinking, you know, we're going to have a new start. It's going to be different this time. Everything's going to turn around. But I think the signal that things weren't going to turn around was when Wolf Blitzer asked Eric Cantor, can you just name me one, just give me one program you want to cut. Just give me one. Asked him this question twice. He couldn't give an answer. That's a bad sign. So that means you're going to continue with the money printing and all the rest of it, because that's what follows in its train.
Yeah, you know, I remember watching, you know, when I was watching some senators on the Sunday morning talk shows, and they were saying, don't vote for the Republicans, because if you vote for them, we'll go back to the failed policies of the past. And I wanted to ask him, which policies are those? Which policies that we don't currently have are we going to go back to?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the whole Obama agenda has been just it's just been Bush on steroids, as you've said. And it's like there is no sane party. There's the stupid party and the evil party. Where's the sane party? And then incidentally, we had John Stewart with his rally for sanity that he had in Washington, D.C. Did you hear that a reporter went around asking people, is Obama a Keynesian? And people were answering, how dare you call him a Keynesian? He was born in America. What are you, a birther? This is how ignorant these people are.
Well, absolutely. But, you know, he's probably more than a Keynesian. He's a socialist. It's, you know, it's beyond just simple Keynes.
Well, I mean, at this point, it's just a matter of you just have to wince every single morning when you open up the newspaper. Just absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I think you really do a good job of explaining, I'd like to hear you talk about it, because everybody is always saying that we had to do something, we couldn't do nothing, that we couldn't let the market fix the problems that the government created, that if we did that, we were going to have a repeat of the Great Depression. And you do a really good explanation of the Great Depression of 1921 that no one's heard of, because the government did exactly that, nothing.
Oh, yeah. This is one of these things that no one talks about, especially when we're told we have to learn the lessons of history. The lessons of history are always print a lot of money and go into debt. That's the lesson of history. So we're not supposed to know anything about this episode where you had a situation where production was down double digits in 1 year, unemployment shot up to double digits very quickly, and you would think there would be calls for public works spending to get people hired. In fact, as Secretary of Commerce, that's exactly what Herbert Hoover was demanding. Was we need more hiring. We need the government to hire people and build bridges and so on and on. But he was, thank heavens, not listened to.
Well, how high did unemployment get in that?
It got to 12.4%.
12.4%. And how much did GDP contract?
By about 17%.
So 17% in what, 1 year?
In about 1 year. And wholesale prices were down 56%. You could imagine Ben Bernanke would be in the hospital at this point.
All right, so that's real deflation. I mean, we're afraid of deflation and prices are still rising.
Yeah, exactly. So prices are going up 2%. We're panicked, right?
So this was a complete collapse in 1 year. The GDP collapsed, unemployment shot up, prices collapsed, and the government did what?
Well, they basically cut the federal budget about in half between 1920 and 22.
So they cut spending? I mean, they didn't stimulate? Spending. They did the opposite?
Cut spending. They didn't just slow the rate of growth, any of this nonsense stuff. They actually cut the spending. And then the Fed, if you actually look at the Fed's record at this time, which you can see if you go to the St. Louis Fed website, you can generate it for yourself, the Fed doesn't actually turn the money supply around until around 1922, when the Depression was already over.
So the Fed was tightening?
The Fed tightened, the discount rate was slightly lowered, but I mean, this is also because inflation expectations have fallen, so all rates are going to be falling by that point. But by and large, the Fed was passive. It still hadn't really gotten to the point where it was engaged in open market operations as a matter of monetary policy until about 1920.
So in other words, we started out with a bigger economic shock, a bigger collapse than the one we have now. We had stimulus, no bailouts, no QE2. In fact, the government and the Fed did the exact opposite of what they're doing now. And we got out of it in how long?
About 18 months.
And then we had the Roaring Twenties.
Yeah, then we had the Roaring Twenties, because the tax cuts that we got all through the 20s, those were phased in again largely after the recovery had already occurred. So it wasn't even the tax cuts by and large. It was just letting the market, letting entrepreneurs figure out where resources belong. When people say, oh, you guys are just saying that we should sit back and do nothing. No, we shouldn't sit back and do nothing. They should. We entrepreneurs need to get out there and, using the price system, figure out where resources belong and what what things need to be liquidated and what things need to be expanded. Only entrepreneurs can do that, and government has no non-arbitrary way of making those decisions.
That's exactly the point. It's not, you know, when the government decides where things go, it has no price signals. It has no way to know what to do, and there's no breaks if they're doing the wrong thing. It's central government planning, and it doesn't work. You know, when things get bad and Bush says we have to abandon capitalism in order to save it, when things are bad, that's when you need capitalism the most.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's the same thing with free speech and all the rest of it. Yeah, I'm all for free speech when everything's perfectly normal and there's no emergency. Well, that's when you need free speech, is precisely in these emergencies. But, you know, imagine if the situation had been reversed. Imagine if we got the Great Depression during the 30s at a time when there was no government intervention, or right now, imagine that we were in a situation where they hadn't done the bailouts and the economy was still sinking. Well, we'd be told that just goes to show that the free market can't solve it. But when in fact the opposite occurs, the government intervenes consistently through the 30s and unemployment is still in double digits and the government engages in all these unprecedented interventions in recent years, that's never used, that's never cited as evidence that the government can't do this. That's just evidence.
Well, here's the problem. The fact is, here's how stupid their logic is. We had a depression. We eventually got out of it. It was the longest one we ever had. And during that depression, we tried all kinds of stupid Keynesian things. And the fact that we got out of it, ergo, it must have been all the Keynesian things we did that got us out of it, even though it took forever. And you can argue that, you know, we might have got out of it a lot quicker if it wasn't for all those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then the whole World War II thing. During World War II, Alvin Hansen, who was the most prominent American Keynesian there was, Hansen was warning that after the war, if we just cut all this wartime spending, then, you know, we cut the federal budget 2/3, we're going to go back into a depression. In fact, he even said, look, when the war is over, we can't just stop building ships. We can't stop building ships for a war that's over. But yet that's exactly what we did. Exactly what we did. And we got the single most prosperous year, 1946, in all of U.S. history. I mean, that's the best.
Well, I know. Well, that's the exact analogy
has ever had, and it failed completely.
That's the analogy I use when I try to describe how much better the Chinese economy would be if they stopped exporting stuff to us.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Exporting to us is the equivalent of making battleships. You know, they're using their resources to produce goods that they don't get to consume. And they're afraid, well, but if we don't sell these goods to Americans, everyone's going to be unemployed. No, they'll be employed making stuff that they need and that they can enjoy. They'll be better off for it.
And yet this war thing, I mean, just the other day, the Washington Post, David Broder had a column, I assume you saw, about, you know, really what we probably need right now to kickstart things is a good war. That would get things going.
But I wrote a very tongue-in-cheek piece, I don't know if you read it, where I said, how can we have the good parts of the war without the casualties? And then my piece was about, we have a pretend war, a fake war. We spend all this money making paint bombs and stink bombs, and we just reenact the Civil War. We maybe have a war with Russia, the Soviet Union. We have a world war. We spend all this money with pyrotechnics. We put it on cable TV, and we can waste all the money we want employing everybody fighting a pretend war. And I said, then we can get all the benefits of a war without anybody dying.
Yeah, that in my book Meltdown, I propose that the U.S. and Japan ought to build the most fantastic naval fleets ever known to man. I mean, just unbelievably sophisticated, and then sail them out into the Pacific, and then evacuate all the people so we have no casualties, and then sink them to the ground, and then we'll have a big party celebrating how much richer we are now that we did that.
Well, you know, that's exactly, though, what everybody does. When the Chinese and the Japanese sell us merchandise in exchange for pieces of paper, they might as well take their cargo ships into the middle of the Pacific, dump all the cargo into the ocean, and then head back, because that's basically what they're doing. Anyway, don't go away. Let's stay tuned. After the break, I want to discuss Nullification,
your
new book. So don't go away. You're listening to Peter Schiff and Thomas Woods. Welcome back, everybody. If my intelligence keeps growing, I will catch up with my guest, Thomas Woods, who is a very prolific writer. I'm reading now, in addition to the book Nullification that just came out, you got a new book already coming out in early 2011, Rollback, The Battle Plan Against Big Government. How do you write all these books, Tom?
Well, you know, when you have no social life, it becomes really easy to get a lot of fish.
But don't you have a big family? You got a lot of kids?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I always, that's the one non-negotiable part of my day. I don't want them to grow up with an absent father. But once they're in bed, especially the last few weeks before a book deadline, it's just complete insanity around here.
So tell me about Nullification.
Well, I wrote this basically because I take real pleasure in sticking it to the commissars of approved opinion who exist in our society. And I've come to the conclusion, I think that a lot of people have reached, that maybe the solution to our problems is not going to come from the federal government, and that the idea that the federal government will just limit its own powers just of its own volition is just wishful thinking. And so that maybe we need to think another way, that if the federal government is going to be limited, something other than itself will have to do the limiting. So what I'm trying to do is direct people's attention to this completely forgotten idea from Thomas Jefferson over 200 years ago, which was precisely this. The federal government is not going to limit itself. So the natural candidate to do the limiting would be the state governments, because the states created the federal government. They have to be the watchdogs over it. Because otherwise, if you say that the federal government can have a monopoly on determining what its own powers are, I mean, this is like letting a fourth grade kid grade his own test.
Yeah, I always thought if I ran for governor, that would be my platform. I would say, look, the federal judiciary has let us down. They're not enforcing the Constitution. The federal government has overstepped its bounds. It's operating outside the Constitution. And I would try to enforce the Constitution from the state with the state police and, you know, not enforce unconstitutional laws in my state. And then see what happens. You know, I mean, it'd be the equivalent of, potential civil war. I guess I don't know if the federal government would send the army into Connecticut, you know, to force me to comply with these unconstitutional laws.
Well, my thinking is that there's strength in numbers. And if you get a bunch of states together saying, well, we're not going to do policy X, and another bunch isn't going to do policy Y, another bunch isn't going to do policy Z. I mean, they're not going to send the tanks into all these places. They're not going to cut off the highway money to all these places. But at least it would be something different. I mean, as I said, 2 years from now, there are going to be a lot of people scratching their heads saying, geez, why didn't the Republicans do anything when they got into Congress? Because that's what they do for a living, is nothing at all. I mean, that is the job description for.
Yeah. Well, I said we have a few, you know, neophytes now, non-politicians, first timers in Congress, and we'll see if they can resist the corruption, the temptations of power. Once they get into Washington and they get all these guys surrounding them and, you know, they know what to do. They've gone through this drill before. They know how to corrupt the Mr. Smiths who show up in Washington every once in a while with all the perks of power. And it's very intoxicating. And a lot of times what happens to some of these guys, and here's how they convince them. They say, yes, I know how idealistic you are and all this, but if you actually do this, you won't get reelected and then you'll be replaced by somebody way worse. So what you have to do is compromise all your principles to prevent somebody even worse from taking your place.
Right, right. Which is why I think in many cases, I think we have neglected local races and local government. I mean, if you had people with real backbone in the state legislatures and in the governor's mansions, then things could actually get interesting.
Yeah.
And that's what I've hoped to bring about. Of course, poor Martha Dean got pummeled by idiots who know about as much American history as somebody who...
Yeah, you know, every single candidate I voted for lost, including Martha Dean. And you know what I will think about nullification? I think what would also help is jury nullification.
Yeah.
If we can get some juries to just vote not guilty when people are accused of breaking federal laws, just that we know are unconstitutional, just vote not guilty.
Yeah, exactly. You know? If your peers on a jury will hold you innocent, there isn't anybody who can get you. So absolutely, state nullification, jury nullification. What else can you do against this regime? I mean, just forget about all the conventional approaches. They've all been failures. We might as well try something different.
See, what I'm really worried about is what are they going to turn to when the paper money they're printing has no value? You know, I am already worried about seizing assets and confiscating assets. You know, starting next year, they passed a law. I don't know if you know about this. But anybody who owns foreign stocks, even if you own them in America, you have to give the government a list of all your foreign stock holdings every year when you file your tax return. So they can log which Americans own foreign stocks and how many shares they own. Now, why do you think they're doing that?
Yeah, I know. Not just out of innocent curiosity.
They know when their money has no value, they need to start seizing the assets of their citizens in the name of the common good or for the better of, all the comrades, you know, we need to do this. And that is something that's really, really scary.
Well, at that point, this is why when people say to me, we can't have nullification because, you know, gosh, wouldn't that just be chaotic if the states decided that they might not do this or that? I think the current situation is chaotic.
Yeah. Anyway, hey, Tom, we're coming up to a break.
You want to figure out how to do what it wants to do one
Tom,
way or another. I don't need to worry about that.
Do you want to stick
protecting my own liberties?
Tom, we got to take a break. You want to stick around to the next hour?
I can stick around for a segment if you'll have me.
All right, well, hang on.
Okay.
We got more of Peter Schiff and Tom Woods coming up in the second hour of the Peter Schiff Show. Don't go away. And we are back, and I'm talking to Thomas Woods. Tom, you know, one thing I thought is interesting, I heard that there was a congressman that was asked about the constitutionality of the health care, and not, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who laughed about it when she got the question, but another person tried to answer it. And the answer was, well, there's nothing in the Constitution that says you have a right not to have health insurance. Therefore, he had just assumed that it meant that it was constitutional.
I mean, yeah, so he's got it exactly wrong. The whole point of the Constitution, as everybody at the time said, was that they explicitly list all the federal government's powers. And the whole point of the Ninth Amendment is that if we haven't listed one of your rights, you are nevertheless presumed to have it. The federal government is not presumed to have a right, a power, unless it's listed. But we, the people, are presumed to have rights unless abridged or less says something.
Yeah, and in fact, most of the states that ratified the Constitution were told at the time that the federal government's powers were limited and defined, few and defined. I would think that now that the courts have said that's not the case, I think a lot of states should be able to get out of it. And so, you know what? I was led into this contract based on fraud. Here's proof that you told me that the only thing the federal government could do was what was written in this document, and now they're doing whatever they want.
Yeah, I there's no question about that. I mean, they say in at least a half a dozen state ratifying conventions, they use the phrase expressly delegated. The federal government has only the powers that are expressly delegated to it. That was the understanding that people went into this thing under. And, you know, it doesn't look to me like health care is expressly delegated. I mean, don't give me this general welfare stuff.
I know. They pervert that clause. They pervert necessary and proper. They say, well, they can do whatever they want if it's necessary and proper. No, they have a specific power. Like, you can have a post office. Okay, well, you can do anything necessary and proper to have a post office. Like, you can build it. So you can order the concrete. You can hire somebody. You can deliver. But it's like it's necessary and proper to carry out the delegated powers. Not that it means, well, you can do whatever the hell you want, even if it's not delegated. If just because you think it's in the general welfare, if they could do everything that they think is in the general welfare, then what's the point of a constitution?
Yeah,
that means they have unlimited power.
Whoever lived thinks that everything he does is for the general welfare. And I mean, just imagine anybody voting to ratify this constitution if it says, you know, look, we got this clause that pretty much says we can do absolutely anything we want. And even Alexander Hamilton favors a strong central government, centralized power. Even he said in the Federalist Papers that the Constitution would be exactly the same if it didn't even have a necessary and proper clause. He says that's just in there for clarification.
I just wish they were smart enough to take – I wish they were smart enough to take it out back then, because, you know, any kind of language – You know that over time, you know, I always have a, you know, dream that I could go back in time to the founding fathers and get them to write it clearly. You know, I know exactly all the ways that it was screwed up, and I would have them write. See, they're writing it for people that are intelligent. They're not writing it for modern Americans. You need to spell it out in, like, you know, Dick meets Jane kind of vocabulary.
You have to anticipate how ambitious politicians are going to interpret a lot of these seemingly open-ended phrases. I mean, Patrick Henry at the Virginia Ratifying Convention said, look, I'm sorry, but I'm worried about this general welfare clause and how they're going to interpret it. And he was told, oh, don't worry. I mean, only a fool would interpret it the way you're worried that it'll be interpreted.
Yeah, but the problem is we're now a nation of fools. They didn't understand this. With all these schools, with all the education we have now, you know, I was on Fox News today, and this guy was trying to say, there's some people that actually want to abolish the Department of Education. Can you imagine what would happen if we had no more education?
Yeah.
Like we didn't have any education before the Department of Education. We had a lot better education. People actually learned. In fact, the reason the government wants to educate everybody is so we learn nothing.
Yeah, you know, of course. What does the government want other than a nation of complete imbeciles, you know, who you know, do nothing other than stare at their navels all day and think everything's fine? Of course that's what they want. And, of course, the Department of Education is such a trivial thing anyway. I mean, what is it? Maybe $50 billion?
No, I think it's about $130 billion. It's $130 billion, but, you know, $100 billion here, $100 billion there, pretty soon you're talking real money.
Pretty soon it's real money. But in other words, there really would be education, even without this 30-year-old department.
But, of course, one of the things that the Department of Education does by subsidizing student loans and now directly authorizing them is they force tuition prices up. So the real cost of this department is not what it spends, but all the bloated tuitions that universities are charging our kids because of these government subsidies.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how government makes things affordable. You make it super high, and then you allow people to go into debt to afford it. That's affordable.
Yeah, that's their strategy for housing. houses. Instead of letting prices come down so that people can afford them, let's artificially prop them up, but subsidize their ability to go into debt so they can buy these houses and be slaves to their mortgage for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, it would be nice to hear the Republicans actually take on a guy like this and say, look, what you're basically saying, sir, is that the American people are too stupid to run their own schools without being told what to do by their betters in Washington. Why do you think Americans are so stupid they can't run their own local schools without a central department?
Well, like, yeah, how did we make it?
Why did they actually fight?
How did we make it to the night? Was it what year is it? 1970-something we got that department, right?
Yeah, it was under Carter.
Jimmy Carter. I mean, so how did we make it? I mean, we won the Second World War. We came up with the atom bomb. We didn't have any Department of Education. We invented the production line. We had the Industrial Revolution. Thomas Edison, you know, Henry Ford. There was no Department of Education.
And in fact, if you look at those old, you know, those old Regents exams from the 1930s that you had to pass to graduate high school, I mean, there are PhDs who can't pass these things. There was no Department of Education.
Oh, I know. A college degree now isn't even worth what a high school degree used to be. And I mentioned yesterday the problem with all these kids in college is there's so many kids now that are going to college that have no business being there. They're only there because government subsidies are there. If there weren't those subsidies, they couldn't go to college and they'd do something that's more lucrative, like learn a trade. I mean, we don't have the skilled craftsmen and tradesmen because the people that would normally go into those occupations are stuck in these government schools running up debts, and then they graduate, they know nothing. Meanwhile, all the good tradesmen are coming in from out of the country.
And you know, it's even worse, I think. I mean, if you could stand there in a college classroom and really see the level of some of these kids, they don't belong in the parking lot of a college. They have no interest in anything you're saying up there, and I mean, none whatsoever. They're just a bunch of drones there because their parents are forcing them to be there, and they're hungover half the time. This is a fact. Any professor, even the leftist professors, will at least admit this much to you, that it frustrates them that the kids don't care, they have no business being there, and that's somehow the untouchable model for growing up.
But then look at the quality of the professors. Look at these Harvard and Princeton and Yale professors who want more stimulus, that want quantitative easing, that think we need bigger deficits. I mean, that's the professors are that low. I mean, imagine the students.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are at the premier universities.
Auburn, the professor says that in the old days, the students used to show up with all these economic fallacies in their heads that he had to refute. He says, now I have to actually teach them the fallacies. That's how empty their heads are when they get here.
Well, I would tell people they come when you go to get an economics degree, you come and the job is to knock all the common sense out of your head. Because a lot of economics is just intuitive, and they got to tell you to go against what seems intuitively obvious in favor of these ridiculous formulas that they got.
Yeah, absolutely. And to me, one of the great things about the revival of Austrian economics is that you now have a lot of you encourage the natural smart alecky aspect of the brighter kids who then want to, you know, really give their professors grief and ask them about Austrian business cycles theory and stuff. So some of these professors are walking into their classrooms white as a ghost.
Lawrence O'Donnell, I mentioned on the show yesterday, actually said on television that if we don't raise the debt ceiling, that the entire global economy is going to collapse into a depression.
I heard that too.
The pillar of the global economy is America going deeper into debt. We owe it to the world to go into debt. Without that debt, the whole economy is going to completely collapse.
I don't know. I mean, is there a comment one can make on this?
You know, have you read the book I wrote, The Little One with My Brother, How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes?
Yeah, I have.
That's a book I really want to see get out there to the young people, into the colleges and universities and high schools for that matter, because that really puts it in very simple, straightforward terms that anybody can understand. And, you know, you read that little book for 2 or 3 hours, and as far as I'm concerned, you got a PhD in economics.
And even more importantly, you are inoculated against anything that anybody might say to you against it, because it is so commonsensical.
Yeah, and you know, and this is just a little tale. I mean, they've got these textbooks that people have, you know, these Keynesian textbooks that are, you know, thick, you know, you can't even read through them with all their complicated, you know, calculus formulas with these charts and graphs and curves, and it's all a bunch of nonsense.
Oh, yeah, and you know what's interesting, Peter, is that they did a study not long ago. How many people actually read the average article in the American Economic Review? You'll never believe, the answer is 2.5. Mm-hmm. So if we exclude the publisher and the author, we got like a half a guy.
And you know, all of these universities, all of these, you know, highly regarded people and all this text, how many people could see the real estate collapse coming in 2008, even the beginning? How many could see this recession coming when it was staring them at the face, right? Yeah. In the face?
And, no, absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And it should have been obvious. It should have been obvious. I mean, I wrote in the book, in the little book, I said it's like a weatherman is staring at a Category 5 hurricane right off the coast of Florida. And he says, sunshine. And then we say, okay, let's keep this weatherman on. He's doing a great job. I mean, he's cool. These supposed economic experts are completely worthless. Yeah. They know nothing about economics.
I linked to your book, by the way, on a resource page I made called learnaustrianeconomics.com. And I list yours as one of just a handful of the intro. You know, obviously people have to read economics in one lesson, but basically just one of a handful of the intro texts that you ought to read to be an intelligent person. And it does, as you say, it doesn't take a lot of time or effort. And once it's in your head, it's hard to dislodge common sense.
I just wish we can get this book to circulate around Capitol Hill. If we can get, you know, more people to read and understand before the actual whole book plays out and we're completely broke, because we are close to that.
Exactly. We don't actually have to live out this book.
No, we've lived out most of it. We just don't have to live out the last quarter of it because we'll all be fishing without nets. That's the problem. Anyway, hey, Tom, I really loved having you as a guest. Appreciate it. And Nullification is the new book. So pick up a copy, and thanks, Tom, for coming on the Peter Schiff Show.
My pleasure, Peter.
All right, folks, that's our episode for today. I really, really, really appreciate all you folks who help spread the word about the Tom Woods Show by sharing episodes on social media, telling your friends about it. The Tom Woods Show is not something you want to keep to yourself, right? You want to tell your libertarian friends about it in case they don't know already. So I happen to like the link tomspodcast.com, that particular domain name, tomspodcast.com, because that redirects you to my entire list of episodes, which includes links to subscribe to the show. You can see every single episode on that page going all the way back to episode number one, tomspodcast.com. You know, that's just, come on now. I'm the king. I'm the king of the airport, yes, but I am also the king of domain names. I'm modest about some things, but when it comes down to really important things like this, doggone it, I'm going to give myself credit. So spread around tomspodcast.com, tell people about it, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.